Rusty Quill presents The Magnus Archives. Episode 57, Personal Space.
Statement of Carter Chilcott regarding his time spent in isolation aboard the space station Daedalus in September 2007. Original statement given April 4th, 2009. Audio recording by Jonathan Sims, head archivist of the Magnus Institute, London. Statement begins. We're all alone out there. I know the statistics, how big the universe is, the probabilities and proximities and the promises of other beings out there among the stars. But I've been there. There's nothing. Nothing but empty, uncaring void, lacing dead worlds and dead stars all together like a tapestry of lonely meaninglessness. Humans have existed for the smallest sliver of a fraction of a moment in the existence of the universe, and we will be extinguished just as quickly. And when we are at last gone forever into the quiet emptiness of death, there will be nothing left but the cold universe. And nothing shall mark our passing because there is nothing to do so. Dismiss me if you wish to. Take comfort in your escapist fantasies of aliens and visitors from other worlds, but there's no proof I can give you beyond the testimony of one who has spent so very long staring into that black and empty infinity and knowing, truly knowing, what it means to be floating and forsaken in an empty universe. I knew isolation experiments could be rough when I signed up. I'm not some naive fool who thought he'd endure a few quirky side effects for science. No, I'm an astronaut, so I do my research. When I was picked for the project, a long-term isolation study set in conditions of low Earth orbit, I read up on as many previous cases and similar experiments from the past 30 years, familiarizing myself with possible side effects and likely psychological hurdles. It was daunting, to say the least. I wasn't keen to experience some of what the previous tests seemed to promise would happen to my mind, but I didn't feel like I had much choice. I'd had my application to the International Space Station floating in limbo for so long that when a private consortium approached me, telling me they'd recently launched Daedalus, a small manned satellite of their own, and needed qualified crew members, I jumped at the chance to go to space at last. I should have realized that what they meant by crew member was lab monkey, but to be honest, even after I found this out, it didn't do a lot to dampen my enthusiasm for the project. I was going to space. There were two other people technically on the crew. I say technically as I never spent any time with them beyond the trip up to the Daedalus. Their names were Jan Kilbride and Manuela Dominguez. I'm sure that they probably did a lot more looking after the station than I ever did, but as far as I was concerned, I was the only one up there. From the chatter I heard before the mission began, each of us had an experiment of our own to be concerned with, but they were also there as a backup in case something went horribly wrong with mine. Since the observing scientists simply didn't have the option of intervening themselves. I remember the man in charge of my particular project, Conrad Lucas, made a face of rather overstated disgust when he told me I wouldn't be up there entirely on my own. I got the distinct impression he was one of those people who feel that ethical restrictions do nothing but bind the hands of the true scientist and leave them at the mercy of their subject's limitations. My section of the tiny space station was completely self-contained. There was food, sleeping arrangements, and zero-gravity exercise equipment, all for my personal use. The single entrance to the rest of the satellite was locked and sealed. It could be opened from either side, but on my side it required a code. I did have access to the code in case of emergency, but I had way too much riding on the mission to even think about being responsible for its early termination. I also had one large domed window. It allowed me a decent view of the Earth below, as well as plenty of chance to stare off into space, which I did quite a lot in those early days. I was told the other astronauts would do their best to avoid that window while doing maintenance or repair work outside. Mission Control had also supplied me with a lot of books and films and other entertainments as, like Conrad had told me at the first briefing, the experiment was into isolation, not boredom. So when I locked that door for the first time, I was feeling in pretty good spirits about the whole thing, to be honest. I knew I was being monitored. There was a little camera mounted on the wall that kept a beady eye on me. It wasn't so invasive that I couldn't get away from it when I wanted to, but for the most part I was happy enough to eat and read and exercise in front of the watchful lens. Obviously those assessing my progress would never communicate with me directly, and they might not even be watching a live feed, so if they had opinions on how I was undertaking my task, I never heard them. Even if my task was just sitting around in a room in space, waiting for my mind to break. I tried not to take too much comfort in the knowledge that there were people watching my every move, as I felt that to find that reassuring would go quite strongly against the spirit of the experiment. I had to really feel alone. That, at least, didn't take too long to set in. I can't honestly see how strapping yourself in to sleep or drinking your juice with a space foil pack on a straw can have much effect on isolation, but I wasn't going to be the one to bring it up. I believe some people would have been more disturbed than others by its location orbiting Earth, but it didn't feel markedly different to me from any of the other isolation studies they conducted over the last few decades. If anything, the silent, rolling green and blue of the Earth far below was another source of comfort. And the sure knowledge of the billions of other people making their way through life who had no idea what was right above their heads. Both of these comforts lasted me almost 6 weeks. That was when I was aware I should start to experience some of the more distressing side effects. I'd already passed through listlessness and a bout of insomnia, and I hadn't been using my exercise machine properly for almost a fortnight. But I still didn't expect the severity of the hallucinations when they began. Twice I was woken up by the sound of a door opening, only to find it as tight as it had ever been. And throughout the daytime, I would occasionally hear footsteps, which shouldn't even have been possible in zero gravity. There was also a blackout for about 20 minutes at one point that may or may not have been real. Certainly we didn't seem to lose power in any other systems, except the lights. So this was all reasonably distressing, but at least it had the advantage of not being unexpected. No, the first warning I got about how bad things were going to get was the spacesuit. The clocks read it as 14:30 UTC, and I was re-watching 28 Days Later, one of the better films that had been provided for my entertainment, when a movement in the window caught my eye. At first I thought it might have been some orbital debris moving past, but then I spotted it. Still at the edge of the domed window, it was a hand. The white, bulky, gloved hand of someone wearing an EVA suit. It started to float slowly across the window, followed by the rest of the arm, then the torso, until almost the whole suit was slowly floating across. I was excited by the idea of seeing another human being at first, even if it was only brief or might compromise some of the work. But as the suit made its painstaking drift across the space outside, it rotated enough that I could see clearly through the suit's visor. There was nobody inside. The floating suit was completely empty, and I started to suddenly get very scared. At last, it had passed right across and off into the night, the other side, and I stopped to try and calm myself in the face of what had been a deeply strange thing to watch. I managed to do so, but only until I looked again out of that window. There were no more empty floating clothes, but I noticed something that for some reason hadn't dawned on me when watching the empty suit. It was, to put it quite simply, impossible, and I must have approached it from 100 different angles trying to make sense of it. The Earth was gone. At first, I assumed it must have been an orientation change, but that didn't make any sense. The planet below had never been hidden from my position before, and if we'd shifted that radically, I would have felt it, I was sure. But still, the fact remained that where the Earth should have been, there was empty, dark space. I must have watched for hours, waiting to see the sun. We were definitely still moving, and from what I could tell, we still seemed to be moving in some sort of orbit. But without a planet below, I have no idea why we kept the same pattern. Regardless, the sun should have been visible sooner or later. After 2 days of waiting, I finally accepted that the sun and the moon had gone as well. It wasn't completely empty out there. Far off in the distance, I could still see stars, twinkling, and probably long dead. But I knew that there was nothing they could do to save me. At some point on the first day, I remembered the camera. I focused my attention on it and began to scream and shout for help in the vain hope that someone might be watching a feed of it and be able to make contact. I cried and begged and pleaded with that camera for almost 4 hours before I was suddenly struck by a terrifying thought. I floated over to it and gently took hold of the cables that fed out from the back into the wall. I followed them along, looking for where they connected to the power or broadcasting apparatus. What I found instead were a pair of neatly severed wires, transmitting nothing, powering nothing, connected to nothing. The camera had never even been turned on, and had certainly not been transmitting anything to Earth. So what data had they been collecting? I still have no idea the answer to that question. But I did feel like I gained some small sliver of control back after spending an all-too-brief hour smashing up the camera. After that, it was time to break out the code and get the door to the rest of the satellite open. I had decided that even if this somehow was simply a really elaborate and convincing trick to examine reactions to certain stimulus in a test environment, it was still far beyond what I had signed up for. One way or another, I decided I was getting out of this damned experiment. I opened the small safe that contained the passcode document and eagerly broke the seal on its container. I was desperate to get out of that door as soon as possible and took a few moments to memorize it. E109GHT8. I can still remember it vividly as I entered that code over and over in an attempt to get that locked door to open. Each time I painstakingly entered it with as much precision as I still had within me, and each time the password field read out what I had apparently typed in. No one is coming.